Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten, mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnet? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto, das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
125 Jahre Fiat. 125 Jahre Deutsche Vita. Feier mit uns und sicher dir noch bis zum 15. Juli limitierte Jubiläumsangebote. Zum Beispiel den Fiat 500. Im Leasing ohne Anzahlung schnapp 125 Euro im Monat. Entdecke auch viele weitere Fiat-Angebote. Jetzt bei deinem teilnehmenden Fiat-Partner.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. I'm Rahul Tandon. Plenty on this edition. We'll be hearing from a donor to President Biden in a few minutes' time. And we're also going to look at the falling costs of lithium batteries and what that means for electric vehicle prices in China.
Electric vehicles are now the cheapest drivetrain in the Chinese market, which is quite at odds with what you see in North America and Europe, where they still come at a significant premium.
But let us start in the United States, because more and more Democrats are directly calling on President Biden to abandon his fight for re-election. This time it comes in the form of the Hollywood actor and Democratic Party supporter, George Clooney. Speaking during a meeting with trade union leaders to discuss his faltering campaign, President Biden reiterated that he was not dropping out.
You know, I said I was going to be the most pro-union president in American history. Well, guess what? I am, and I'm staying there. No, I mean it.
Four more years! Defiant words there from President Biden. But what will the money men do? What will Democratic donors do now? Jeffrey Sonnenfeld is the president of the Chief Executive Leadership Institute at Yale University. He was on the call with President Biden's team the day after his disastrous appearance on the CNN debate with the former President Trump. I started by asking Mr. Sonnenfeld about the comments made by the former House Speaker, Nancy Pelosi.
Nancy Pelosi, and I know the former Speaker Pelosi very well personally, I think she's hedging right now. It is true she lost George Clooney. In heavens, what would we ever do if President Biden loses Barbara Streisand or if Milli Vanilli should sing in the wrong way? I don't know. A week ago Monday, I was on a call with 560 major donors with the campaign committee. President Biden was not on that call. It was terrible. They managed to accomplish a miracle, and that is they managed to actually subtract from our knowledge that the more they spoke, the less we knew. It was pedantic, patronizing, dumb comments filled with platitudes.
Well, can I just interrupt you there for a minute? Clearly, that was a call that didn't go well with business leaders. You were on it. You've described it very eloquently there. Now, if the same call took place, do you think the donors would be in the same place they were a week ago? Have they been reassured by some of President Biden's performances?
Remarkably so. Because, in fact, that did happen on Monday. We had the perfect experiment. After he went on the MSNBC network, that was unscripted. That was interactive and open. And then that afternoon, I was on a follow-up donor call where he was not expected to be. He was not announced that he was going to be on the call just before the call began. We got a notice that the call is going to be delayed briefly with a special guest. We know then, only then, that it was going to be President Biden. And it was actually more people than were on the week before, but some major donors who were on the week before that I know well were so dismayed by the prior week they didn't join, so they were disappointed when they heard how well it went, because there was incredible donor enthusiasm. If you saw the clip, any of the clips from this, even though it was technically off the record, it was very enthusiastic, it was interactive, informal. Candidly, the questions he was asked were not very difficult questions. But it didn't have the same pre-screening or scripting effect of before. It was almost jocular. It was relaxed. It was like the old Joe Biden. I mean, not old Joe Biden, but like the former Joe Biden, not the elderly Joe Biden. So the donors, Basically, they're kind of where Nancy Pelosi is that her position is a nuanced one. She's extending the probation through this week.
Is that what we're looking at now? Are we talking about the donors making a decision, a final decision, maybe in the next week or two? It can't drag on. Either they're going to continue to support President Biden or they're not. And how important is that money to him?
You said that so annoyingly well. I wish I was interviewing you because you're exactly right. They're given about a week to two and it can't drag on. By the time we get into the Republican convention, of course, which is next week, those donors will have made up their minds. But right now, there's an extended probation. They want to see how he does in what's going to be an extremely difficult press conference tomorrow. The Washington Press Corps is understandably enraged, angry, and skeptical. And it's going to be as difficult a press conference as anybody has ever had. And it's going to be almost impossible to not come through that unsinged. He, of course, knocked it out of the park with the NATO speech. And people say, well, it was off a teleprompter. Well, that's a lot of the job. I'm glad that he can read a speech and make good decisions and he knows who he's talking to. But there still are other dimensions. But the donor class has a wait and see attitude. No CEOs, no major CEOs have drifted to Trump as a result of this. Back at the debate debacle, it led people to start coming up with other candidates. I can't tell you the number of times CEOs kept suggesting to me the same solutions that they thought were original.
Who was the most popular candidate with the CEOs?
By runaway, the most popular candidate was not Gavin Newsom, the governor of California. It was the governor of Michigan was the number one on everybody's list. And she is now the co-chair of the Biden-Harris campaign. So
what were they saying about Kamala Harris to you?
They're worried about her polling numbers, that she has greater negatives than Trump does. But they also respect her experience and they think she's eloquent. Sometimes her speeches are very good. And sometimes, like President Trump's, they can meander. But there's a sense that she wasn't always given the ideal assignments to prove herself, but that she's extremely smart. She's eloquent and loyal. So everybody thought she must be in the mix, but I didn't hear very much sentiment that she should be a natural anointment. Only one CEO that suggested give her a trial run as vice president stepping into the presidency. Very few people were harboring that thought. Most everybody thought there would have to be some sort of an open convention last weekend. This is until Monday. Now, that's gone to the back burner, and it's a wait and see how he does, especially the rest of this week, especially tomorrow afternoon.
It's been a fascinating conversation. What's your hunch in terms of what the donors are going to decide? Do you think eventually they will say, President Biden, this time it's not for you?
They were there, I hate to say this, they were there 2 weekends ago, and most of them were there last weekend. They're not there right now, but there's one thing we didn't discuss, and that's the one thing which he may not give them, but they want. They want to know, what is the explanation for that acute cognitive break, that impairment, the memory loss, the loss of executive function, the loss of focus? That was not a bad debate night. That was poor mental function. They want to understand what happened.
Fascinating to hear some of those conversations that Jeffrey has been part of between the donors and the Biden campaign. The governor of Michigan that he was referring to there is Gretchen Whitmer. Let us move on to a story that has been closely followed on Wall Street, because the founder of a private investment firm in New York, which collapsed leading to banks facing multi-billion pound losses, has been convicted of fraud and market manipulation. The Financial Times' UK legal correspondent, Joe Miller, has been following the case. Just tell us, Joe, thanks for joining us, who's been on trial here and the company that's been at the centre of this?
Sure. Thanks for having me. The man on trial is Bill Wong. And prior to March 2021, very few people outside of financial circles in Hong Kong and New York had heard of him. He had run a small family office called Archegos, which it turned out 3 years ago had essentially built enormous positions worth tens of billions of dollars in just a handful of stocks, a handful of tech and China-focused stocks. And essentially, he had done all of this without anyone really clocking that he was the person behind all of these positions. And when these stocks started to go sour, the entire global equity market started to wobble. And it turned out that he had amassed all of these risky bets. They were going sour. And as you mentioned there, they ended up being unwound very, very fast in a fire sale and leaving major banks, including Credit Suisse and UBS, nursing billions of dollars in losses.
Yeah, an extremely important case at the time. He's been found guilty now. So what happens next? Has he been sentenced yet?
He has not. The sentencing will take place on October 28th. So there's a few months to go until that happens. But in the meantime, we can expect Bill Wong to appeal. He hasn't confirmed that at present, but you certainly got a hint from his lawyers during trial that they felt that the charges in this case, which amount to market manipulation charges, securities fraud charges, etc., that they were unwarranted. They claimed all the way through that Bill Wong merely loved these stocks and he built massive positions secretly in these stocks because he believed in them and there was nothing manipulative or deceptive about that. And indeed, many legal scholars who've been watching this case have also raised eyebrows as to, you know, how you can prove manipulative intent and, you know, not just that this person really wanted to and really believed in these groups that he was buying. So there may very well be an appeal and much more to come on that front.
Joe, thank you very much for joining us here on World Business Report, an important legal case there. Now, another issue that we talk about a lot here on the program is tariffs. The extra taxes that are placed on the imports of particular goods by governments. On Wednesday, the Biden administration decided to place tariffs on imports of Mexican metals, those that are partially made in China. It's being seen as a politically motivated move to prevent China from getting around tariffs on steel and aluminium. But what will the effect be? Erica York is senior economist and research director of the Tax Foundation, a Washington-based think tank. So much for joining us. Thanks so much for joining us on the program, Erica. Just explain what has actually happened here and why Mexico is seen as so important in this case, particularly when it comes to steel.
The announcement today has to do with Section 232 steel and aluminum tariffs that were originally put in place under the Trump administration. They applied broadly to steel and aluminum from most of the U.S.'s trading partners. Eventually, exemptions were granted for Canada, Mexico. Agreements have been now reached with the EU, the UK, Japan as well. But one issue that has come up is that in order to get around the tariffs, there's some indication that steel from China is being shipped through Mexico with slight changes done in Mexico to then transship it into the United States and not have to pay these 25% tariffs. So the idea is to clamp down on instances of that happening, though I would say it's not a major issue. Most of the steel that we import from Mexico originates either in Mexico, Canada, or the US.
But this still is an important case, isn't it? Because there is a lot of concern at the moment, as we see the US putting more tariffs on some Chinese products like electric vehicles, that Mexico might be used as a way of getting them into the US without paying tariffs. So an important moment to some extent.
Yeah, I think so. I think directionally it really hammers home the point that we're in a sort of new, unfortunate era of US trade policy, and that's when we're both leading presidential candidates of both parties favor higher tariffs. We're seeing that protectionism will continue under Joe Biden and that it would greatly accelerate under Donald Trump. But we know that the economic ramifications of these are higher costs for U.S. producers, higher prices for U.S. consumers, and we don't really see improvements in outcomes in China, with whether it's a concern of overcapacity or IP theft. Those practices continue
Sorry to interrupt you. Some would say it helps to protect jobs in the U.S.
It helps protect jobs in certain industries, but that comes at the expense of other industries. And we have, you know, data from the US ITC, from academic studies that show, yes, tariffs can redistribute income towards protected industries, but downstream industries are left holding the bag. And in the United States, steel consumers outnumber steel producers about 80 to 1. So there's significant risk of more job loss from higher steel prices than there is job creation or protection from those higher steel prices.
The ITC being the International Trade Commission in the US, 30 seconds if you don't mind. We're seeing this on metals. Could it be moved to other products as well, do you think?
Yeah, I think we've seen the Biden administration talk about higher tariffs on solar panels, EVs, steel and aluminum from China, battery components. So I think this is a new era where we do see increased protectionism in, you know, whether it's green technology, whether it's these, industrial sectors that are important for defense, or whether we're talking about Trump more broadly, tariffs across the board. There's this idea that we can use protectionism to boost U.S. economy. But unfortunately, we can't. We know the outcome is a negative impact overall.
Thank you so much, Erica, for joining us on the program.
Wer die Finanzen eines Unternehmens managt, ist oft beschäftigt. Sehr beschäftigt. Sehr, sehr, sehr beschäftigt. Konto ist das All-in-One-Geschäftskonto, um Ihr Unternehmen zu managen. Egal, ob Sie selbstständig sind oder die Finanzabteilung eines mittleren Unternehmens leiten, mit Konto erledigen Sie alles in einer App. Geschäftskonto schnell eröffnen? Erledigt. Ausgabenmanagement? Erledigt. Buchhaltung und Reporting? Erledigt. Konto, das Geschäftskonto, das zu Ihnen passt.
125 Jahre Fiat. 125 Jahre Deutsche Vita. Feier mit uns und sicher dir noch bis zum 15. Juli limitierte Jubiläumsangebote. Zum Beispiel den Fiat 500. Im Leasing ohne Anzahlung schnapp 125 Euro im Monat. Entdecke auch viele weitere Fiat-Angebote. Jetzt bei deinem teilnehmenden Fiat-Partner.
You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Erica there was talking, wasn't she, about electric vehicles. So what's going on with lithium-ion battery prices this year? They're a key part of that particular sector. In short, they're plummeting and the implications are just starting to ripple out across the automotive and power sectors. We've been getting more on this from Colin McCretcher of Bloomberg News Economic Finance, who's been looking very closely at what's been going on and what this means for electric vehicles.
What you're seeing is a really sharp drop over the last year. So in China, where the most of the batteries are sold right now going into electric vehicles, battery prices fell 51% over the last year and now sit at $54 per kilowatt hour. My team at Bloomberg NEF has been tracking this market for over a decade now, going all the way back to 2010. And it's fallen steadily over that time, but this is the sharpest drop we've seen in the last 10 plus years of covering this market.
So I'm sure you can answer the next question. Why have we seen this substantial drop now?
Yeah, there's several factors. One of them is just falling raw material prices. So things like lithium, cobalt, nickel, those are all really down over the last 18 months from their highs. And that's because more supply has come online, and also because maybe demand hasn't been as high as expected. So there's one around raw material prices is a big part of the story. There's another part of it around overcapacity. So there is a huge amount of battery manufacturing capacity already online in the world, significantly more than the world needs. And there is more coming online every day. Everybody wants a piece of this big part of the energy transition, but that's pushing the market into overcapacity, which means manufacturers are cutting prices to maintain market share, and their margins are being compressed in the process.
When we talk about overcapacity, that is a term that's used a lot when we talk about China nowadays. Is that where most of that overcapacity is when it comes to batteries?
That is where most of it is today, but there's a lot of manufacturing capacity in the pipeline in both North America and Europe, and also to a lesser extent, India. So one of the things we're watching is, will all that additional capacity that's planned in those regions come online, or will a bunch more of it be canceled in the years ahead? When you have overcapacity, what you generally see is that there's a big shakeout usually. The companies with the best cost advantage generally survive that, and some of the weaker ones go under. I think what we're seeing right now is that this price dynamic is going to make it very hard for some new entrants to enter the market. And there are a lot of new entrants who are trying to enter this market over the next little while. So we're watching that dynamic closely, but I'm anticipating there's probably going to be a bit of a shakeout in the next few years.
What about technology? As batteries get better, we need less of them. Is that also a factor here?
Yeah, technology. The technology is still improving. We are nowhere near the end of how good a lithium-ion battery can be. So we are still seeing very significant technology and manufacturing process improvements in making lithium-ion batteries. And China's biggest battery giants, particularly, are investing really heavily in factory automation, in R&D, and they're just launching a lot of new products into the market. So it's not just overcapacity. It's not just falling raw material prices. The underlying technology is also still getting better, and people are getting better at making them.
People will be sitting, listening to this, and thinking that means the prices of electric vehicles are going to continue to come down more and more over the next few years. Do you see this pace of the pace of the fall in battery prices continuing?
So that's whether it continues at the same pace of the last little while, I don't think so, because some of that is all these factors coming together at the same time. But certainly something we're watching is whether those price drops in China are reflected elsewhere outside of China. And certainly right now you see increasingly tariffs and trade barriers going up, preventing that from being the case. So I think we're going to end up with a bit of a fragmented market for a while where there are some really low prices in some places, but maybe not as low prices in others. And certainly in China, it's worth noting that that is already leading to very, very low prices for electric vehicles. Electric vehicles are now the cheapest drivetrain in the Chinese market, which is quite at odds with what you see in North America and Europe, where they still come at a significant premium.
Let's bring in Susan Schmidt, head of public equities at the State of Wisconsin Investment Board. I just wanted to go back to something that one of our guests said earlier about an increasing level of protectionism when it comes to trade. Is that what your analysis of what we're beginning to see in the global markets at the moment?
Well, I think that's certainly what investors are expecting. They're increasingly cautious around what potential impact tariffs might have and that reduction in trade and what it will do to companies' operating margins.
Yep, that is the case. Let's talk about Jerome Powell. It's been an important week, hasn't it? He's the chairman of the Federal Reserve, the US Central Bank. He seems to be indicating that maybe those interest rate cuts that we've been talking so much about may be close now.
Maybe, but the market is certainly taking his comments today as he reported to Congress as a positive and that we might see those rate cuts as soon as September. So today's comments received very well by investors in the U.S. with the U.S. markets, S&P particularly, hitting a new high over 5,600. And that index now is up 18% for the year with the NASDAQ up 24%. Clearly, investors are optimistic that rate cuts are coming and this will be beneficial for businesses and the economy.
Explain to our listeners that US markets continually powering forward at a time when there are concerns that the economy is slowing down. How does that square up?
There are concerns, but the markets are forward-looking. And so they do think that with Powell's comments, Chairman Powell speaking positively about inflation getting under control, that means that he will be able to lower interest rates. Lower interest rates mean less burden on businesses. That benefits them longer term with their earnings. And so investors are looking forward into this, thinking that with lower interest rates, it's going to get easier as a business climate. And that backdrop of an environment will mean more profitability and therefore higher share prices.
30 seconds for you, Susan. If there is no rate cut in September, does it get harder after that as we get closer to those elections?
Well, markets are eternally optimistic, apparently, with investors. We do see them trend up over time. That election year noise has been happening throughout the year. Does it enhance and increase as we get closer to year end? Absolutely. But I think investors have basically taken that in stride now. Markets are already pricing in and betting on who they think will win. At this point, markets are favoring President Trump. It remains to be seen, but investors will look past this. I think interest rates still stay dominant as the main topic of discussion.
Susan, as always, thank you so much for joining us on the program. Let's move to Europe now, because Greece has introduced new regulations to limit the areas on beaches that bars and restaurants can use. The rules are intended to leave enough space for the public who complained about exorbitant prices charged by beachfront businesses that restrict their free access. Our Southern Europe correspondent, Mark Lowen, reports.
Ah, a Greek summer. Island hopping, ouzo at sunset, and often a scramble to find a patch of sand to lay your towel amid sunbeds that cost the earth. But now Greece is cracking down on beach hoggers, issuing new rules for seafront businesses. Their tables and sunbeds must be at least 4 metres away from the water to leave free space for the public, and they won't be allowed on smaller beaches. The government has issued more than €350,000 of fines in the past week for illegal beach concessions, using drones and satellites to spot offenders and launching an app for people to lodge complaints. It comes after locals formed a so-called towel movement to protest against current practice. One of its members, Tassos Telolou, spoke from the golden sands of Paros Island.
We're just my family in a beach, and we put our towel down and our umbrella, and we said, okay, this place is reserved by us. We know our rights, and we're going to stay here. They don't like it, but they have to accept it. The beach is a public space, like a square or like a street. It belongs to everybody.
Do you feel you will be helped by the new regulations?
Yes, if they are implemented.
That will be the challenge, policing Greece's thousands of miles of beaches and confronting businesses that are charged high rentals by the state. Freeing up sand for the sunseekers will require a sea change in mentalities.
Let's get more on the so-called towel protest. Maura Lavelle is a journalist based in Athens. She told me that these new regulations are going to be pretty hard to enforce.
It's going to be very difficult. Prior to this regulation, which passed in March, on a regular beach in Athens or on a popular tourist destination island, you would see sunbeds and umbrellas taking up almost every square meter of sand on the beach. And these beach bars and cafes and restaurants, they're all individual businesses. Greece has hundreds of islands. So cracking down on this and following through and implementing this regulation is going to be incredibly difficult.
I was interested when you talked about this growing anti-tourism sentiment. It's something we've talked about on our programs in many different parts of the world. But it's a difficult balance to strike because that tourism brings a lot of revenue into Greece as well, doesn't it?
Correct. So tourism is around 25% of Greece's economy. And on popular tourist islands and destinations such as Santorini, it's 90% of the economy. Something like one in five Greeks work in some aspect of the tourism sector. So it's a massive, massive part of the economy. It's not something that Greece can simply give up. However, locals here are saying that there's no regulation. People are unable to rent homes at prices they can afford. They're unable to sit on the beach, unable to walk around their village.
Give me your own personal experiences of the problems on Greek beaches. What have you seen when you've been to some of those beaches in terms of being able to find somewhere just to sit down and where you don't have to pay? And how much do you have to pay sometimes?
What you have to pay varies greatly. At a small beach bar in a beach, say, outside of Athens where I would go, a sun lounging chair and an umbrella for the day could be, say, 20 euros. However, on Santorini, I know it can reach around 100 euros, which is unaffordable for your average Greek person. When I go to the beach, there are certain beaches where there is not an inch of space for you to put out a towel. Everything has been completely taken over by lounge chairs and umbrellas and loud music coming from the beach bar. And it can really swallow the entire natural area.
Are some people worried? I was in Santorini last year and it was incredibly crowded with coachloads of tourists. Is there a danger that if Greece is seen as being not tourist friendly, people will just go to another part of the world and those businesses then and the country as a whole will lose a lot of revenue?
Of course it's a risk, but the question is playing out here is a question of sustainability. If you have so many tourists, for example, on Santorini where you visited, who are all buying water bottles, there's no water on the island and the waters are becoming completely polluted, it means that the place will not exist for anyone. Other places have put regulations. It's a big question of sustainability.
It is a big question of sustainability. Maura Lavelle, the journalist based in Athens. That is a discussion that we're seeing and a story that we're covering in many different parts of the world. The benefits tourism brings in terms of revenue against the impact they have on the environment. That's it for World Business Report.
125 Jahre Fiat, 125 Jahre Deutsche Vita. Feier mit uns und sicher dir noch bis zum 15. Juli limitierte Jubiläumsangebote. Zum Beispiel den Fiat 500. Im Leasing ohne Anzahlung schnapp 125 Euro im Monat. Entdecke auch viele weitere Fiat-Angebote. Jetzt bei deinem teilnehmenden Fiat-Partner.
Bye.